What I'd like to do is discuss documents slightly more generally, actually. In fact, we have done that today. And try to convince you that there are really natural ways of geometrizing various spaces of digital documents. So the documents don't necessarily have to be text documents. They could be music documents, or multimedia documents, or sensor documents of various kinds. Basically, as we said, I mean, a document, once you put it in vector space, is just a point in Euclidean space. And the real issue is, how do you organize the points in Euclidean space in a way that's sensible and corresponds to the kind of inferences and similarities or affinities you may want to impose on the documents. So that is one of my goals, is to describe some of that geometry. We already heard today some methods of trying to geometrize and parametrize sort of data sets in Euclidean space, or data sets on a graph or in a metric space, by doing multidimensional scaling or by doing eigenmap or things of that sort. And will be quite clear immediately that building eigenfunctions of some appropriately chosen data matrices has a property of self-organizing the data. However, when one is dealing with document, with text document for that matter, we actually do a lot of things. When we have a corpus of text document, the first thing that we do is organize them into folders, okay? And the different folder organization is really the organization that we like to use. On the other hand, this is on the side of the text. Then on the side of the vocabulary, it itself is being organized into folders, which are different levels of abstractions of words. And they correspond, if you wish, to meta words. Sometimes they get their own word, right? Like flowers and specific plants, for example. So the issue is that in the context of text documents, we actually build a whole other structure there. So what I would like to show you is that the folder structure that we build naturally, either on the columns or the rows of a text of a Word document matrix, is a completely general methodology that can be done in the context of general matrices of data, whatever this thing is. In other words, you can build the language of the data, and you can build the folders and meta folders. And not only that, but in effect, this construction has the same self-organizing ability as building the eigenmap, and mathematically it's equivalent. Okay, so the miracle is that mathematically it's equivalent. This is something discovered, if you wish, in the Zygmunt schools almost 80 years ago, realizing that Fourier series and wavelet analysis are basically perform similar functions. Wavelet analysis is folders and scaling and bookkeeping, and Fourier series is Fourier series, it's eigenfunctions of some operator. So what I want to show is that this is actually the case in full generality. And it might provide you some ability to understand things a little bit better. So, as I said, so I want to relate the spectral properties of some matrix, Laplace operator on the graph, to the intrinsic multiscale folder structure induced by a natural geometry. And again, let me skip things and describe to you why what some of the things that we heard, I think, should be a little bit modified. Okay. The first observation is this. When you take a dot product in dimension, which is large, like 70, as we heard before, or 100, or 10,000, the generic situation is that any two vectors are orthogonal, and the distances are always large. And using Euclidean distance as a global object is not a very efficient tool, and not even a good tool to infer anything. So we use in correlation usually when we compare vectors as a way of deciding that there's some affinity between the two points. They have a lot of if you wish, features which are the same, if you think of the features as a coordinate of a vector, then you use correlation as a way of measuring how similar the two documents are. As I just said, correlation is for the birds, okay? And really for the birds, as this example will show you. Take those two pictures of the digit one here, which are mildly rotated one from the other, and view them, each one of them, as basically a document of zero ones. So if this is, whatever, 64 by 64, then it's just a string of zero and ones. If you correlate them one to each other, that means you put one on top of the other and count how many black spots they have in common. And that's not too many compared to the total number of coordinates. So the correlation here is really lousy, and that's really not a very useful way of saying that those two digits represent the same object. On the other hand, if I were to only to take this one and just tilt it a tiny little bit, okay, less than a pixel, then that correlation would be close to one. So infinitesimal variations and correlation is quite good as a way of measuring. In other words, if I had this and I tilted it by a tiny angle, the correlation will be large, and I would be quite sure that the two pictures correspond to the same object. Okay, so just a tiny little disturbance of that is okay. A large disturbance is not. On the other hand, if I have a database of the post office digits of one, which they want to have, then I have a lot of, in my database, there's a whole multitude of such pictures, and then the question is, can I infer that this digit is the same as that? The natural way to do it is see if there is a pass connecting in the database this to that. And if in that pass, I'm pretty sure every time I move from one object to the other that I'm still a one, then I'll have some probability of not having changed character, if you wish. On the other hand, if I had not only a single pass, but in such a database, there will be probably billions of different paths, and each one of them is an inference pass that tells me that one is one, then looking at that total inference as a way of measuring the affinity between those two documents, if you wish, is a very powerful inference tool. And so what I'd like to show you is that this is actually very simple to do and very easy to compute, although I described something relatively complex. So, let me just skip a few things. Here is another example. I come back to the formulas in a minute. So we have heard this morning, for example, about when you have data about the sort of diffusion, about the geodesic distance on the graph. So let's look at all the green points here as a graph. If I look at the shortest path connecting B and C, it's roughly the same length as the shortest path connecting A and B. But if I think of the points here as basically infecting their neighbors, okay, then the shortest path is sort of an irrelevant thing. So in particular, think of this just as a motivation. Think of this two green patches as two patches of shrubs out here in the Hollywood Hills. And the question is, lightning hits at B, what is the probability that C would catch fire compared to the probability of A catching fire? Okay. And it's rather clear that the risk of C catching fire is much higher than that, because assuming some probability of fire being transmitted from one shrub to the other, there's many more paths connecting B and C than there are connecting B and A, because they all have to go through this bottleneck out here. Okay? So in reality, we have here two clusters, right? I mean, this fire cluster and that fire cluster. In terms of documents, the way we are going to go to documents, we would think of the points here as being documents, and think of the sort of affinity between documents as a probability of inference that one document relates to. And when we want to have documents which are far away from each other, we would look at all inference paths connecting them and then decide that if there's more inference paths from B to C than from A to B, the probability is higher, then they're more related. Okay. Okay. I mean, another sort of simple example of that would be if I wanted to measure, say, my political influence, the way I would do that is by saying that if I know, say, George Bush, maybe I'm an important person, except that, or know somebody who knows him directly, then the pass would be two. And that's a fact. There's one of the deans at Yale has been his roommate in college, so everybody at Yale knows him, so it doesn't mean anything. So the fact that the pass is two doesn't mean anything. On the other hand, if I were to think about it in a different way, let's say I were to transmit a message to him through all of my acquaintances, every time the message changes hands, the probability of reaching further drops, then the preponderance of transmission pass will actually measure how likely it is that I will actually communicate. And that's a decent measure of at least one way of doing it. And I'll show you how it applies to different documents. People like this is not new, by the way. As you see, this is an old paper of Zimmer, Sloanim, and Tishby. And what they were trying to do is actually, let's say you have a few documents which are labeled, say, here and here. And then you want to, but you have one cluster, which is this one, the other cluster, which is that. If you just do straight nearest neighbor, you're dead, right? I mean, this is going to be all confused. On the other hand, if you start to link each document to its next one and nearest neighbor like this, and you diffuse, all of those will diffuse here, and all of those will diffuse there. You will have it will follow sort of the nonlinear link structure between the documents rather nicely. So in general, the algorithm, by the way, to do something, there's something remarkable, which I'm going to describe in a minute and then drop as quickly as I can, which is this. If I were to just have a collection of points in Rn, so those could be latent semantic indices of documents, if you wish, at the XI, or could be weight frequencies weighted by entropy, or any way you want to do it, it doesn't really matter. And I want to start to get those things organized. In principle, I could do this. I could define a similarity between two words as just being Euclidean distance between them, okay? But then most words are between two documents as just being Euclidean distance. But then, as I said, Euclidean distance is not particularly useful, nor the correlation. And so I will truncate that Euclidean distance by some parameter epsilon. And there are some ways of deciding what the right epsilon is, but let's not worry about it. And then define this as sort of the affinity between document X and Y. In other words, this now is a similarity between X, Y, which is the exponential of the distance between them. And when you do that, you can define a matrix, which is a Markov matrix, M, and which you can interpret as probability of one document being near another one, or being having an inference on the other one. And again, I'm not saying this is good, bad. It's just a way of doing it. Okay. And when you look at this matrix, this is sort of the the scaling method that you've seen this morning, but except here I'm doing a multi-scaling method. So the multi-scaling method is this: I will take a point X in my document space and would map it by looking at the various eigenvectors of that matrix. Those are vectors of label I and J, where I corresponds to the point, but I will put the point in there to indicate that this is really a function of the point. And then map a point to the point in Rn, which is lambda 1 to the t, lambda 2 to the t, lambda k to the t, phi k, where the lambdas are just the eigenvalues of the matrix. This relates much more closely to what we heard this morning about the potential matrix that we have seen with the inverse Laplacian. Except that this is a heat diffusion, and the t here represent time for diffusion relative to that heat. There is a big advantage in doing that, which I will explain in a minute. In any case, once you do that, you realize two things. One is that if you look at the original matrix...
I'm sorry, is T an index? Or
T is an index. It's time. And I'm going to use T.
But that's not an exponent, right?
It's an exponent. It's lambda 1 to the T. I'm taking the eigenvalue to the T.
To the T's power.
In other words, those are the eigenvalues of the matrix, which I have here, m to the power t. Okay, so take the m, view it as a diffusion. Take t steps of diffusion, you'll get m to the t.
Uh-huh.
And those are the eigenvalues of the matrix, m to the power t. Okay, I view each step of diffusion as a propagation of fire, and I'm asking myself what would happen if I wait a certain time, and what would be the probability of it reaching from point A to point B. So the various entries of m to the t are probabilities of going from I to j in time t. Okay? Now, the point is that this probability matrix gives also rise to a metric. Okay, so it's a matrix of I and j, but I relates to x and j relates to y. So the matrix mij was this one. And it turns out that if you just do the polarization identity, this quantity here is a metric on the data, which is exactly equal to this Euclidean metric of the points which are mapped by this mapping in the Euclidean space. So the distance in Euclidean space is exactly equal to this distance in original document space, and this distance in original document space basically tells you the probability, or if you wish, the risk distance of propagating from x to y in times t. Okay, so this measures the risk of propagation from x to y in time, or the one over the risk of propagation from x to y, and this is just Euclidean distance. So this complicated measure of distance in the space, in the shrubbery space, becomes a very simple Euclidean distance here by this embedding. Okay, so that's a tremendously useful numerical advantage, which I may have it here. I will now explain. Where is this embedding? Just a minute. I got myself somehow disorganized. Let me explain some examples. So here's an example. This is the same shrubbery in the Hollywood Hills, except there are trees and shrubs. Okay. And the situation is that there is some transition probability of fire going from a, say, a shrub to a tree, and from a tree to a shrub, and so on. And so the issue is you want to have some assessment of where is the risk of going from, say, this point, a fire propagating in some time t from this point to that point. And this embedding with the two eigenfunctions of that matrix, in this case, the matrix is actually probabilities of transitions, provide us this picture of the scenario. And this picture tells us that the Euclidean distance down here relates to the risk of fire propagation. Okay? So it tells us that in this location here, everybody is related to everybody, and in a short time, fire is going to propagate from here to here, while here, the situation is quite different. Although the statistics is the same, nevertheless, it turns out that in this case, there's more shrub trails going here. The fire propagates faster on shrubs, and more trees sort of crossing and slowing the fire down here. So you see, you have a way of deciding who is connected to whom by just looking at a single picture of the data. So normally, let's abstract this for a moment. Suppose this were a million documents that were embedded in two dimensions, and I want to know, given any pair of documents, what is their affinity, I will need to have a table of a million squares numbers. What I'm saying here, once I map it down here, I only have a million documents, and to know the affinity, I just take a ruler and measure the distance. So this table only has a million numbers, not a million square numbers, okay? Because the way of measuring affinity is just your
two million numbers, right? You've got two coordinates per.
Oh yeah, 2 million numbers, or 5 million if I map to that.
Sorry, I'm not picking on you. I just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah. It's exactly that. Yeah. So, by the way, this kind of thing. So I'm going to go from document to document. I'll return to text documents in a minute. So here, this issue of using diffusion metric. Here is an example of that. This is a collection of documents. In what sense? Every pixel on this image has a signature, which is 64 numbers displayed here. This signature is actually a spectrum of the pixel in 64 bands. So you see that the green ones correspond to this signature, the blue one correspond to that signature, and the pink one correspond to this one. And you could ask yourself, all right, now I want to classify all other documents in here. So I labeled them by hand. And I want to classify all other documents in this space here, whether they're blue, pink, or green, okay, which are different tissue types in this case. Well, if you do nearest neighbor, okay, in the 64 dimensional distance, you're doing okay in this region, but it starts to be total garbage out here. Because there is a sort of nonlinear variability as you go along, okay? And if you compare one of those things, you see this one is identified as being blue while it really should be pink, okay? On the other hand, if you take the distance in this diffusion metric, which I've just described, relative to the metric defined by the matrix of affinities, and then the situation is quite a bit better. So it's really, as I said, in high dimension Euclidean metric is only useful if you just move a tiny little bit. And if you want to move a long distance, you have to chain together all kinds of chains of inference. By the way, another way of doing that is with different documents, for example, usually what you will do is SVD. So SVD would mean you take two documents, you take the dot products, you may have normalized them to have length one, so this is a cosine of the angle. And as I said, usually cosine of the angle between two random objects in high dimension is usually zero, or close to zero, so that's garbage. So you might as well do something much simpler, which is decide that if this is close to one, say larger than 0.9, you accept it and you set it to one, and if it's below that, you just set it to zero. Okay. Or if you want to do it smoothly, you could do this version, which is take 1 minus that, divide by epsilon, which is what I did before, and then repeat the same thing I did before. That's really what I did before. It's just okay. So in other words, taking the correlation matrix and just brutally truncating it and setting it to zero whenever correlation is meaningless, okay, is an extremely useful exercise in this case. Now again, if one is lucky, and I'm trying to explain very rapidly some of the underlying mathematics, if the spectrum of this matrix, actually this should be M, I'm changing notation, if the spectrum of that matrix is like this, it's always less than one, it's a Markov matrix, then the various powers which you get by diffusing at different times, so here I diffuse in 16 time steps, have a tendency, because it's less than one, they basically reduce the rank of the matrix, numerical rank of the matrix, substantially. So if I took a very high power, the rank will be maybe 4, 5, 10. Okay? And that's why when you take the diffusion with time 10, you actually get this ability to measure in low dimension the actual diffusion. It's a fast way of computing diffusion, if you wish, for long times. Okay, let me relate it to document. I think many of you here know about what is called collaborative filtering for documents. Okay, collaborative filtering is something that, say, Amazon would do to recommend something that you should buy, right? They will look at something they know about you, they will look at all the others which have similar, who have done similar things, and look at how they would rate the group, your affinity group. They would look how they would rate. What is the probability of buying certain books? So it will rate the other books, and it will give you a listing by the rating that you would have. Okay. Well, it's exactly what we have been sort of doing. Assign to a document or a pixel P, if you wish, assign a vector of features. If you wish, it's a person P, assign a vector of books that the person bought, okay, and then compare it to all the other people. If they're close enough to it, okay, then you make this a Markov matrix by dividing by the sum over Q, and then you apply it to the data that you have on all the other books, and it'll give you the scores that you would assign to the other books based on whatever they have in their database. Well, let me do this on images. So let's P be a pixel, and let's a vector assigned to a pixel be just a sub-image of size 5x5, okay? And then just apply this to the actual pixels of the image. Okay, this is was done by Arthur Slum, who is right here. And so here are the image, and I just did this collaborative filtering. I assigned to each pixel the feature vector, which is it's a little patch of the image around it. And I compared each patch of the image to the other patches and used that to sort of rebuild it. As you can see, the advantage of that is that none of the edges have changed or anything. By the way, that's a procedure that many people here at UCLA, like Stan Osher and others, have been actually applying to analyze images by just doing heat diffusion on images. Okay, and they've used other features, if you wish, than that. But that's exactly what it does.
This looks a lot like non-local means of Morel, bringing the cursor offline.
But it's local. I'm just looking at the 5x5 box around it, so I'm not doing that. But it's exactly the kind of thing that you've been doing. In fact, it just puts it all in the same bulletin. I didn't know you were here. Okay, the other thing, as I was saying before, this spectral analysis does something remarkable. It does. There is a sort of minor miracle involved. It actually allows you to take a completely garbled set of documents, in this case it's a collection of images, and you just compare them by their dot products when the dot product is sufficiently close to one, and then get them organized. In this case, it just sets them according to the orientation. Here's another one. Each image is one of those little 3D spots here, which were taken in different orientation and different illumination. They were all thrown down on the table, completely garbled, no order, nothing whatsoever. Okay, so you have nothing in there. And the issue is, again, so you compare the, so each document in here is a little image like that. Okay, and there was a set of such documents. Then, again, you embed the set of documents, the raw data is given, no a priori knowledge about anything. Then the data is organized. Every data point corresponds to one dot here, and what is done here is the dot is being overlaid on the image that gave rise to a given dot, that was mapped to a dot, is really being overlaid on the dot. So what you see here is the organization that those two parameters gave you. And in fact, what you see is that what you perceive is basically essentially the orientation, the normal vector. Essentially that, those are the two parameters. Okay. And nothing, there is no a priori knowledge, no interference, no vocabulary, no nothing. And in some sense, the vocabulary is being built. For documents, again, this is a science news thing. I will return to that. One can do the same story. You can organize a document and map them to a given into a given shape. I'll return to that a little bit later when, Mauro will talk about this in much greater detail than I. So what I'm claiming is basically that mathematically you can use the eigenfunctions, which is a mathematical computation, to organize, to sort of map the data using the eigenfunctions. It somehow works, you have no idea why. Okay. In other words, it's not a nuts and bolts type activity. And I mean, you have an idea why, it's very easy to mathematically prove it, but that's not the point. So what I'm really saying is that we can organize the data in folders, okay, based on diffusion geometry at different timescales, and generate a folder structure and a collection of basis functions like the eigenfunctions of this matrix, such that you would, first of all, be able to embed the data into low dimension, And secondly, build the language of the data and the folders of the data. So let me try and convince you of that. And if you are interested in more, as I said, Mauro will describe the analysis. By the way, I really should have said this. Our goal in this exercise is not clustering. Clustering is nice. Our goal was to do signal processing on document spaces, okay? So in other words, there's a function that you know on document space, and you want to basically, it's an empirical function, you want to analyze and approximate that empirical function to be able to say something, okay? So the document could be the medical document of some patient, okay? And the function is the state of health of the patient. And you have a million patients and a million state of health that you have, and now a new patient comes in, and you want to be able to infer something about the state of health of that particular patient based on the different affinities that his different tests had with all kind of people and so on, okay? So the same thing, it could be a customer. You want to know, is this going to be a good customer or not based on how he resembles other people. So it's a generic thing. It's inferences on the documents that are important, not so much the documents. So you want to organize them, and the geometries usually will depend, the nature of the diffusion you will do will depend on your goal in life here. I mean, there's no single diffusion. I just gave an example of some. So let me explain a little bit. So I want to basically build a hierarchical multi-scale folder structure without clustering. Okay. So my goal is something else. If I have points distributed uniformly on the interval 0, 1, I can't cluster them. Okay. There's no such thing as clustering. On the other hand, I can organize them in binary intervals, right? I can look at each point, I can look at the binary coordinates of the point. And that's an organization of the points. So in other words, M is a point in the first half or second half of 0, 1. Is it in the first half of the first half or the second half of the first half and so on. So what I want to show you is that this kind of construction, you could actually take any set of points and have a multi-scale tree like that, if you wish. And it corresponds and will correspond to the affinity at different time scales. So we have a scaling which is time. By the way, this time scaling is exactly the scaling that, as I said, people doing image processing have been using as a way of introducing scales into image analysis. And so here, let me say this. If the diffusion, if you wish, if the kernel for the diffusion, so this is the matrix for the t's power of the initial matrix that I had is given by k index t x y. Think of this as a probability of going from y to x in time t. Then if I have two subsets, e and f, I can define the distance between them by essentially looking at the Tuck characteristic function in e and f and applying kt to this and measuring, take the O2 norm here. This is sort of essentially, it's like diffusing from E to F in time 2t and seeing what I get. Okay. Anyway, this is a good way of defining a distance between two subsets, okay, which is a diffusion distance. So now, I will say this. We can take, in a metric space, so this defines a metric on subsets. Just the square root of that is a metric between subsets. In a metric space, it's relatively easy. It's a standard construction going, I don't know when, at least 80 years back, of covering the metric space with sets which have diameter roughly 1. Okay, so what do I mean by that? I mean, a set will have diameter roughly 1 means that it contains a ball of radius 1 and is contained in a ball of radius 2. Okay? So the way you would take a metric space and cover it with such things is very simple. If this is my metric space, I pick a point, I pick a ball of radius 1, and then, or let's say, yeah, I pick a ball of radius 1 around it, and then pick a point in the, or I'm sorry, pick a ball of radius 2 here, and pick a point in the center, so here's my point, then pick a point outside, take a ball of radius, a distance, a point outside, and then until I cover the whole thing, okay, with balls of radius 2. Okay. And then it's clear that the balls of radius 1 here are all disjoint. Okay. And so all I have to do is take a ball of radius 1, see what I missed here, add it to this one, whatever is left here that I missed, add it to this one, and just cover the whole. So it's just a, I'm not saying it's a good construction, it's just one construction. Okay? So I can do that on any metric space. So the idea is that to build a multi-scale hierarchy, you start with all this, the document graph we cover it with disjoint sets of rough diameter 1 at scale 1.
And scale, you don't care how you made the graph.
I don't know. So the graph is a graph. It's a
where it comes from.
No, but it's a diffusion graph. I'm looking at diffusion type
right.
1.
Right. Okay.
So this would be basically all nearest neighbors, essentially, and just extend a little bit. Okay? So this will be my first generation on the original data. Okay? Then that gives me a collection of disjoint sets here. I have a distance between those sets. Okay? That's a new graph. Okay? And I repeat. Okay. So this organizes this metric space into disjoint collection of folders whose diffusion diameter at scale, it's the first thing at scale 1 is roughly 1. Then what we do is take the collection of those folders, organize them into folders of folders at scale 2. Okay. So I'm now diffusing twice as long and keep the radius 1 and repeat that. So what I'm doing, it's much easier to explain on the image. So I've taken this, the folder, say, here's one folder, here's another folder, which are disjoint things. Then I'm looking at the group of those as a new superfolder, it's a parent folder, and there will be another group here, and maybe another group here. Okay. Now I diffuse twice as long. It's always the same diffusion. It relates the point relative to the original metric, okay, but at longer time scales. And I can now take an accumulation of those, and it gives me a grandparent folder. And then I double the time scale every time when I go. So it builds a tree. So it basically builds sort of, I have the thing, I have the original small folders, then I have bigger folders, maybe, and so on. Okay. The point is that every time I do it, I allow the paths or the connections to be longer and longer. Okay.
So maybe at this point it's worth pointing out that there's no difference between a metric space or finite metric space and Euclidean space for all intents and purposes,
right.
Because you can embed n points in log n dimensional space, which is very small, with almost no distortion.
So this thing here is just a way of organizing the document into groups which have some sort of local affinity. Two folders which are disjoint really don't have to be disjoint. They may belong to the parent, or maybe by accident they don't. I should have smeared this thing anyway, but that's not the issue. So when one is doing this construction, there is a corresponding construction of those of you who know about the R basis. It's an orthogonal basis which is obtained by basically looking at functions which are constants on the various folders at different scales and orthogonalizing them. Okay. So you can actually build an orthogonal basis for the space of functions on the data. Okay. Now, what's happening is this, if you just smooth them a little bit, is that when you're looking at the very coarse scale functions, the one at the top here, they correspond to the top, they span the same space as the top eigenfunctions of the Laplace of the diffusion operator. So if I look at the coordinates in those spaces, okay, and use them as an embedding in Euclidean space, they do the same job. Okay, in other words, the embedding would be essentially a thing. Okay, so I don't need eigenfunction. What's the point? You will see in a minute. I mean, if you wanted to try to think about, let's say that our brain was doing something like that, how would it do it? It will never compute an eigenfunction. Right? On the other hand, it will compare the similarity of neuronal sensory inputs and will organize them in groups of similarities and can basically reduce the data dimension this way. So let's return to documents. Again, this is the same science news thing. The various folders that you generate in this way correspond to some of the colors here, and let me just indicate. So this was a work done by Morrow. And again, you see that you have in this kind of folder is a physics folder. Here we have astronomy and planets. So those folders were done by a method similar to that. It's not slightly more complicated, but not exactly. Conceptually, it's the same. And you have the other folders corresponding to various topics and their similarity in there. They are really, as I said, there are really two folder structures. If I have a Word document thing, I have a folder structures on the documents, which are groups of documents which are tightly linked. And I have a folder structure on the words, which are group of words which are seen in the same way by the document. So we have substantial co-occurrence in the document. Okay, and that's great, but just to, and in a way, we all do it by hand. But let me just give you an example here of what happens if we have sensory inputs and we follow this procedure. Okay, so here I have no language. Okay, I have data. The data is basically a lot of those little things here. Okay, and so in other words, this is an image. The data I have is all 8x8 sub-images of that image. Okay, that's my group of documents. Let's think of an 8x8 patch as a document. And let me organize this into, again, I can build a graph of that. I'll show you what the graph is in a minute. And when I do that, I can organize it into folders at different scales. So here is one folder. Here is another folder. And those are the largest. And you see the folders are featured in this example. Here is another example like that. This is an image of the same kind. The patches are the same patches that I've seen. The actual organization of the relation, when you look at the first two eigenfunctions of the graph of patches, they're organized this way, and you see that they correspond roughly to the orientation of the edge here. Or if you wish, they actually can be, if you take three eigenfunctions, you see that the data, all the documents in this data set lie on a sort of sphere like this, and if you wish there are two parameters basically. One of them is the orientation, which is a circular parameter this way, and the other parameter is the amount of black in the picture, or the amount of white in the picture, which is the other parameter going this way. Okay, so this is one representation. That's another representation. But basically, what I'm saying is that when you look at a collection of nearby documents, they correspond to a piece of curve here. And that curve had nothing to do with the actual particular data. In other words, if I wanted to build primitive vocabulary to describe black and white images, right, the vocabulary for black and white images are just those little folders of related patches. Okay, it's basically when I have a string of them, it's one of them. And here, such a little folder is just would correspond if I go back from the data back to here, will give me a little edge, okay, or another edge out here, or another edge out here, or a white spot or so. So it's completely abstract. Okay, it does not rely on any semantic anything, and in fact, one is building, if you wish, the sort of the fundamental language of the data as it occurs in the matrix. OK? Okay, I'm not saying it's a good language, but it's a beginning of doing that. Let me, just to finish, let me give you another example of that, showing why this is an example of a multiplicity of sensors, all measuring some phenomenon here. Somebody was, right, this is a torture device of the 30s. You put electrodes on your head and you try to measure. So the documents are basically every document is one electrode that gets a signature in there. Okay, and you want to understand really what is the underlying structure of the things that you're measuring. And you want to understand how they are related to each other and what the relationship is. And again, if you do that and you normalize correctly, you find out that all electrodes give you basically this sort of saddle. So think of it as the horse's head is here and the tail is here, right? But it turns out that if you only had four of them, or another set of four, you get the same thing. So basically, it doesn't really matter. It's completely redundant information, which is tightly linked together that you can actually get. That way. So this is a digression. But the point here is that semantic and text documents are really great as an inspiration, and you think that you have no way of transferring any of your sort of understanding of language and so on into a context. Well, language doesn't have anything to do with it. Right? In fact, it doesn't exist. In reality, it's essentially equivalent. Our natural way of organizing documents or vocabulary is completely equivalent to this multi-dimensional scaling type, or multi-scaling in multi-dimensions, which is what we're doing. But you need the multi-scaling. You will not see that if you had a single scale. Okay, so the time parameter there does play a role. The time parameter is the one that told me what was the length of chains of inference that I was saying. So I started with short chains and then I took longer chains and longer chains and longer chains. That defines the different folder sizes. And defining that, I can view a folder as a meta document, okay, or a meta word. So that's basically the message. As I said, several people are going to continue on that, in particular Mauro, describe in greater detail what the underlying analysis in mathematics is. But the goal is to understand and develop sort of signal processing of data, whether you mean filtering, cleaning, filling in missing data, inferring empirical functions, and all of that. And at this point, it seems that all the tools for conventional signal processing can carry over.